You're listening to KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One. With KCBX News, I'm Greta Mart. A California native himself, San Luis Obispo resident Dr. Matt Ritter, is passionate about the state's native plants. We invited the professor to the KCBX studio this week to talk about his recent work, the county's flowers, and why it's important to keep a check on invasive plants. I'm here in the studio with Dr. Matt Ritter. And you are a botany professor in the Biological Sciences Department at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. And you study California's native plants and cultivated trees. You're the author of several books. And now you have a new book coming out.
I do.
First off, how did you get Jerry Brown to do the foreword? Do you know him?
So Jerry Brown, my previous book, the person who did the foreword for the previous book, his name is Peter Raven. He's probably the world's most famous botanist. He was the president of the Missouri Botanical Garden for years and years. He was also a professor at Stanford. And he is a friend of mine, and he and Jerry Brown went to high school together. So Jerry Brown is a friend of a friend.
And so you just sent an email, or how did that happen?
Oh, no, it all happened through Peter.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if I'm sure there are some people in California who just can send an email to Jerry Brown, but there aren't very many. Now I can, but not before.
So tell us about this new book.
It's a sort of the layman's guide to all the wonderful diversity of plants we have here in California. California has over 5,000 native plant species. It's one of the world's biodiversity hotspots. Here on the Central Coast, it's a biodiversity hotspot. Within a biodiversity hotspot, we have so many species. Something you may not know is that we have more species in San Luis Obispo County than the entire state of Alaska. So it's a lot of diversity over a small area, and, you know, relatively hard for people to understand that. But the idea of the book was to get people to celebrate it and appreciate it, and then ultimately lead to some kind of conservation efforts. Now it's more important than ever that we do conservation of our California native plants. And so I partnered with the California Native Plant Society and the Wildlands Conservancy, two great nonprofits. Some of the proceeds of each book go to support those two nonprofits in order to support the work they're doing.
Before here, I was in Alaska. Gosh, there sure were a lot of plants there.
There were, but imagine a place that's, you know, way, way smaller than Alaska and about 700 more species here than there is in the state of Alaska.
Wow. Okay. So take me through the process of when you conceived this book.
Right. First of all, I teach a lot of classes about California native plants. Many of those are to non-majors at Cal Poly, so people who initially couldn't care less about plants, and then find themselves in a plant class. And I'm constantly trying to ask myself the question, how do you get people interested in something that they're not initially interested in? Well, beautiful photos and fun stories oftentimes can be a key to getting people interested in things. And I used that concept when writing the book. The book is full of stories of our plants. And in writing that is non-technical, and then a lot of beautiful pictures, there is about, nearly 500 to 600 photographs in the book. It's 350 pages, full color. It's the idea is somebody would flip through it and think, oh, this is fascinating. This is what is this about? Why should I be interested? And the book will answer that question for them.
Did you take the photos yourself?
Did
you hire?
Everyone, with the exception of probably 10. A student of mine named Kyle Nesson took several of the photos. He's a wonderful photographer. And I borrowed four or five photographs from some colleagues of mine. But the rest of it, I'm pretty proud of the, all but 10 or so of the 500 photographs are mine. And I spent a lot of time outside in California photographing plants, and it's one of the joys of my life to do so.
And so did you work with this publisher before? Did you just say, I have an idea for a new book, or did you have to shop it around? Or
I worked with them before. I have my previous book is called The Californian's Guide to the Trees Among Us. It's a treatment of the trees that you would see in urban areas in California, so right outside your front door on your street and your park and park trees and garden trees, that kind of thing. And the idea of that book, which was published by the same publisher, was to get people interested in the plants that are around them in their yards and all of that, and give people a way to identify trees on their street. In a way, I felt, if people could get interested in the tree in their front yard. That's in a way, that's sort of a gateway drug to them caring more about plants in general, and then ultimately leads to caring more about forests and everything that comes after that, conserving what we have in California.
How did you come to San Luis Obispo to teach at Cal Poly?
I grew up in Mendocino County, and I somehow, I don't know, I got into UC Santa Barbara as an undergrad. So I spent 6 years in Santa Barbara. I graduated high school from a very small public school with 16 people.
Wow.
Yeah, in Potter Valley, California, in an interior valley in Mendocino County. My first biology class had more people in it than in the town I grew up in. So it's just kind of culture shock to find yourself in Isla Vista after growing up in a small town in Northern California.
And did you go as a botanist?
A biologist. Major? No, I got a degree in biology from there, actually microbiology. Mm-hmm. And then I was always interested in plants. I grew up doing woodworking and interested in redwood and interested in large trees. I grew up around a large valley oaks. And when I went to grad school, I met a person there who ended up being my PhD advisor, a guy named Bob Schmidt, who got me very interested in plants. We all have experiences in our life where you meet somebody who's inspirational about something and you get interested in what they're interested in. I think that's part of good teaching, actually. And so he got me interested in plants, and I ended up as a PhD student studying corn and the development of the tassel in corn and really developmental biology of plants. And then this job came up, and I had two brothers who were undergraduates at Cal Poly, and so I knew about it, and I knew it was a great school, and so it's kind of a dream job. And I was right. I've been living the dream for 15 years now. It's a wonderful job. And
you've been here for 15 years?
15 years, yeah.
Wow, terrific.
Yeah.
A couple Sundays ago, I went for a hike. It was through the city, and mm-hmm. it was on
wildflowers.
Yeah, exactly.
Got that's to the called top and, Bowden Ranch yes, is what it's it. Called. Yeah,
that's right. And then they came down. I kept going because I wanted to do Reservoir Canyon.
Oh, you went all the way over?
So I went down Reservoir Canyon.
It's a great hike.
And I recognized, once she showed us, one was that looked like lasagna.
Yeah.
Tell me about the plant that looks like lasagna.
The plant that looks like lasagna is called soap plant. It's a native lily, and it has these strap-like leaves with really wavy, undulating margins, and it's a bulb, actually. Most of the plant is underground. You're seeing just the strap-like leaves that come up, and then in the summer, it blooms with these beautiful white flowers, a little larger than a quarter size and diameter. And the interesting thing about, well, there's many interesting things about that plant, but one really neat thing about that plant is that its flowers open and close every day when they're out. So they'll be closed at night, open in the morning. And they close during the middle of the day and then open only in the evening. So they will open for this little period of time in the evening. If you cut that whole flower stalk off and put it in water, it'll continue to do that even indoors. So it's got some kind of clock that it knows what time of day it is. Pomeridianum. Pomeridianum is the specific epithet. The genus is Chlorogalum. So the scientific name, Chlorogalum pomeridianum, means post-meridian, meaning it blooms only in the late afternoon.
Wow. And can you eat it?
It was actually an important food. More importantly than food for it is that it was crushed, and it has a saponin in it that will gum up the gills of fish, and so it can be crushed and put into dammed areas, and it stunned the fish, and it was used for fishing. That was an interesting native use of it. And that bulb itself is surrounded by these coarse hairs that were wove into really intricate little brushes and things like that, and we still have some archaeological evidence of its uses for that.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah, it's a great plant. And that hike over Bowden Ranch is a wonderful hike, especially right now, because we have some, first of all, around the city of San Luis Obispo, we have a number of really great open spaces. And the city of San Luis Obispo has done great work in preserving open spaces around it. And Bob Hill, who is our city natural resource manager, has done great work, and Neil Havlick before him, acquiring places around the city of San Luis Obispo where you can go on just very, very short distances away from where people live. You can be out in open, native, natural areas. And we have serpentine hillsides. Serpentine is our...
What does that mean?
Yeah, so that's our official state rock. You may not have known we have a state rock. It's this blue-green rock that's on... you see the open rock outcrops around San Luis Obispo. And it's a really interesting rock type because it's kind of toxic for most plants to live on. And so the plants that do occur on it evolved on it. And so they are usually special, rare. They only occur on that. And in fact, we have some species that occur on the serpentine rock outcrops around San Luis Obispo that occur there and nowhere else in the world. And we have a rare and endangered little lily called the San Luis Obispo Mariposa lily. And that's out now, and it'll be out for the next month or so. Calochortus obispoensis. It's a beautiful little hairy red and orange flower. And if you do that hike again in a couple weeks, and I know you're going to want to do it in a couple weeks, you'll get to see the San Luis Obispo Mariposa lily. Great plant.
Wow. Okay. Terrific.
Yeah.
I just thought of a book that I read quite some time ago, and it advanced the theory that there is no such thing as native and non-native, that it's all just evolution.
Well, let me just address that idea, because in California, we have this very specific date, which is 1769. Before 1769, we don't know actually a lot about what was going on in California with regards to moving plants around. And before that, at 1769, the Padres cross the Tijuana River estuary and come north and start to set up missions. And at that time, they brought plants from Europe with them. So in California, that date is important in this in a invasive plant ecological sense, in the fact that we consider everything that was here in California before that to be native, and everything that was brought in and is now growing and reproducing on its own afterward to be non-native. Now clearly plants have moved around the earth for millennia, and at speeds though that are much, much slower than what is currently going on with human introduction of plants to new areas. And so to compare the migration of species at an evolutionary time scale over millions or hundreds of thousands of years, which took place forever on Earth, to what is going on and has been going on in the last 200 years is an errant comparison. It is not natural in the sense that if you want to use the definition of the word natural as not involving humans and human interactions and so on. And so yeah, humans have done things very quickly that didn't take place in the past. And the danger of that is it's a potential loss of biodiversity. We are in what many of scientists are considering the world's sixth mass extinction event. And that is being caused by human activities over in a geological time, just an instant of time, the last couple hundred years, and where we're seeing species extinctions at orders of magnitude before just a couple hundred years ago. And so those types of things, it's a very difficult case to make that's natural or is just mirrors like what has always been going on Earth. It's just too fast. Same is true of climate change, right? Climates have changed in the past. We know that. We have great evidence that climates have changed, but they haven't changed at the speed at which it's currently happening. Plants have always migrated and gone upslope and downslope and things like that associated with climate change, but the speed at which it's happening now, some plants may not be able to recover from that, and some habitats may be destroyed because of that.
Is part of your job documenting and just in case these species do disappear? I mean, do you have...
100%, yeah. I'm very interested in documenting plant diversity, right? And so as an example, Cal Poly has 3,000 acres of called the Swanton Pacific Ranch just to the north of Santa Cruz that is a beautiful 3,000 acres with many, many plant species. In fact, over 10% of all the plants that occur in California occur on that 3,000 acres. And I'm taking a new graduate student with a colleague of mine, Jen Yost. The two of us are co-advising a new student next year to do the flora of Swanton Pacific Ranch. We want to know the baseline data for what is there and where it is And this same kind of work needs to be done all over California. What do we have? Where is it? Because if we don't know what we have now, we won't know what we're losing in the future, or how things are changing and how to predict change and how to respond to it. All those things are very important. And getting that baseline data of knowing where everything is really crucial.
Wow, what a fun job. I'm just going to camp out there and spend a year or however long.
Can you imagine
long?
Getting a master's degree? Just
a blast.
Yeah, it's a blast until you have to start writing all the where everything is and writing the actual master's.
Yeah.
Writing is the hardest part of science, I say, and it's the it's what makes you powerful, though.
Right when you came in, I was working on the story about the Oceana Dunes. What do you think of that? So they're going to mark off another 100 acres. And they're going to revegetate. What will they revegetate with, and how will that work?
Yeah, my understanding is the way the revegetation takes place there. So all that stabilization and even the smallest amount of disturbance in that situation can cause what we call blowouts, where you have a plant that's stabilized an area, somehow something goes that kills it, either foot traffic, off-road vehicular activity, whatever, and then the sand starts to move again. And starts to bury all the other plants around it and so on. And then you get an active dune. You go from stabilized dunes to active dunes. Well, you can reverse that. And they will collect, and they've already, people will work on this, collecting native plants from the area and seed stock and cuttings from plants that are in the area and use those to revegetate. Usually with revegetation projects, people collect plants from the closest to them as you possibly can. And that ensures that you get the local genetics and allows people to revegetate things in the way they were and not bring in native plants from other places in California. And so, blocking off areas of the dunes to allow for stabilization is important, right? Stabilized dunes are much more pro-human than destabilized ones, in the sense that there's less particles in the air, and all the things that go along with moving sand and all of that are very problematic. And stabilizing those dunes is important, and stabilizing them with native plants is really important.
In terms of like mustard, how would you ever said we must deal with it? How would you ever deal with it? It's everywhere.
Yeah. So that's a great question. That's a question that is a very difficult question to answer. And obviously, it is case by case. It's dependent on the species. It's dependent on the location. I'll give you an example of really great example is the 90 acres that's in Los Osos called the Elfin Forest.
Right.
The Elfin Forest.
I spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, it's so beautiful, and it's a window to the past in many ways, because it is what Los Osos Baywood, that whole area, probably would have looked like for millennia, and really great that it's been conserved, right? Imagine if we didn't have that, if it was houses there. And it's the northernmost extent of the Morro Bay Manzanita, a federally endangered species that occurs out there. It's a great habitat, and it is constantly weeded. People make a huge effort all the time, volunteers, to go out there and take the African veldt grass out of the Elfin Forest. And so they've drawn a line in the sand in some sense and say, no, we're not going to allow any non-native plants to occur in this area. And it takes a huge amount of human effort to do so. No non-native plant can hold up to human effort if it's put towards it. But the problem is that it's just sometimes the problems are so big and the resources are so little that you look away and 5 years later, you have a spread of a non-native plant. Early detection of new invasions of plants is really important, because you can nip things in the bud and actually not spend that much time and effort and money on them early on. Mm-hmm. So that's really crucial. Something like black mustard that is everywhere and the cat is out of the bag in that sense, management of it, trying not to let it go to seed in places where it's really problematic are things that people do. But a lot of it is just managing a current problem. But not letting it invade areas that are uninvaded, I think, is crucial. And that's a management practice of a lot of people who deal with non-native plants. What if we picked a line in the sand? What if we said the Morro Bay sand spit, which is this biodiversity hotspot? We actually know that there are species on there that people care about and that are rare and cool. What if we just decided the Morro Bay sand spit, we're going to come up with the resources to be able to keep native and non-native plants off of it? That'd be difficult to do, and it would probably be costly, but it may be worth it. maybe worth it if we could have that as a place, a reservoir or a refuge for native species that are always occurring there and have always occurred there.
And that doesn't happen now. I mean, there are non-native plants on the sands, because I recently rented a kayak and I went over there.
Yeah.
And I loved the little, just out of total sand, there was nothing else around, and yet that green.
Yeah, it forms a little mound.
Yeah. What an incredible plant.
Yeah.
I mean, it you know, I'll pick the most inhospitable place to set
right,
up shop.
Right, and it does well there. Yeah. Beech bursage is what you're
okay,
talking about.
Alrighty.
And fascinatingly, beech bursage has the ability to change the environment. It can germinate in moving sand, and then the sand slows slightly around it, and it grows, and the sand slows, and it grows, and it forms what we call hummocks, these mounds that you see on the open dunes.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, if it does well enough, it can completely stabilize an area, which allows for other species that would never be able to grow in moving sand to start to grow there, and so on. And so plants stabilize the dunes, and it's an awesome thing that happens out there. And you see successional events where they're in different parts or times in the stabilization. And so the Sandspit and Montaña de Oro and the Morro Bay Sand Dunes is a great ecological place. We take field trips out there all the time. And that's why it's so troubling and problematic to see the African veldt grass and how hard of it seems to be in some areas an intractable problem where it's, what do? You go out there and you pull out every plant, but even the smallest little bit left over has the ability to become a whole new plant. So it will take years and years of focused concentration by humans everywhere in California and other places in the world to make sure that we're careful about non-native plants, where they occur, where they're grown, and do very good work at figuring out where to put our effort. Because some plants aren't as problematic as others. You mentioned the blue gum or eucalyptus. Not that big of a deal. It actually doesn't spread out very much. And you can see that in the lines of original trees in Montaña de Oro. It's not as if blue gums took over Montaña de Oro. They're just, they're there. And they may be replacing themselves a little bit. And they're big, so people care about them. But as weeds go, not that big of a deal. Meanwhile, the African veldt grass is running like a wildfire underneath it. And that is where we need to be putting effort.
Okay. All righty.
Thanks for talking to me. I hope to see some people out on Thursday night at the Slow Vets Hall for a talk about California native plants.
Okay. 7 to 8:30 p.m.
Yep.
And you are Dr. Matt Ritter.
Yeah. Thanks for talking to me.
Okay. Thanks.
All right.